from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Sunday after Super Bowl Sunday. And so just some house cleaning, some housekeeping before we move. As we always must, forward. We can't look back. What? What's that back there? The host of this program was at the Super Bowl on the day of the game, thanks to a very generous friend. And so I was in the stadium as the lights went out. Now, I will say this. There's never been a better Twitter event in the history of Twitter, because, you know, when you, blackout is not really an accurate term. There were enough lights in the stadium for the game to have been played, as a matter of fact, which everybody in the stadium knew. What we also knew was that it wasn't going to be played until enough lights went back on so that it could be on television, you see. So we're all waiting for enough lights for television. But in the meantime, there's no TV monitors. There's no PA system. There's no ticker around the edges of the seats, the seating areas. So there's no way to know what's going on except for Twitter. And the very first piece of official information that came on Twitter, as we were all desperately hitting our phones, was a statement from the utility company. I was going to say public utility, but then I remembered what era we're living in. The utility company, Entergy Corporation, coincidentally the only Fortune 500 company to be headquartered in New Orleans. And what a kick in the head that is. So Entergy Corporation issues a statement on Twitter within about, I don't know, 5 minutes of the thing happening, saying this is not in Entergy's equipment. We've examined our systems. This is in the equipment of the customer, meaning they were pointing the finger at the Superdome and Superdome officials and the state of Louisiana, which runs the Superdome, and Louisiana taxpayers. And that, you know, that went all around. It got on the AP wire, everything. And so that was the state of knowledge in the first 3 or 4 days after the blackout, until Thursday, when just before a hearing at the New Orleans City Council to investigate the cause of the blackout, or the state of the investigation of the cause of blackout so far, Entergy quietly issues a new statement. It was a relay in some equipment that was meant to prevent mishaps. But it was installed last fall as part of the upgrade in the looking forward part of the process going towards the Super Bowl. And it failed. And as gently and as delicately and as discreetly worded as the statement was, you could, if you squinted hard enough, make out the fact that it wasn't the Super Bowl's, the Superdome's relay. It was Entergy's relay. It's a relay sort of understates it. It's in one report reputed to be the size of a truck, but it's Entergy's truck. So thanks for the tweet, babe. And by babe, I mean the only Fortune 500 company headquartered in New Orleans. Hello, welcome to the show. From the French Quarter in New Orleans, you've heard of it, in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. In case you're wondering, we now have kind of a definitive state of knowledge as to the difference between the previous presidential administration and this one. In the previous one, they covered up and refused to release the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion on why torture was legal. In this administration, they're preventing the release of the Office of Legal Counsel's explanation of why extrajudicial killing of American citizens is legal. So there you go. We finally know. Ladies and gentlemen, there are standards. This weekend, an awards program is being held in Los Angeles. And in the advent, in the run-up to that award program, this memo came from CBS, the network that is much like the Super Bowl is broadcasting the awards program, from Program Practices. Those are the people who make sure TV is nice. CBS program, I'm now reading from the memo. CBS Program Practices advises that all talent appearing on camera please adhere to network policy concerning wardrobe. This is the Grammy Awards, of course. Still quoting, please be sure that buttocks and female breasts are adequately covered. Thong-type costumes are problematic. Please avoid exposing bare fleshy undercurves of the buttocks and buttock crack. I got addicted to that one time. Returning to the quotes, bare sides or undercurvature of the breasts is also problematic, as are grammar. Please avoid sheer see-through clothing that could possibly expose female breast nipples, as opposed to other kinds of nipples, I'm sure. Quote, please be sure the genital region is adequately covered so that there is no visible, quote, puffy, unquote, bare skin exposure. Please avoid commercial identification of actual brand name products on T-shirts. Foreign language on wardrobe will need to be cleared. Obscenity or partially seen obscenity on wardrobe is unacceptable for broadcast. This as well pertains to audience members that appear on camera. Finally, the network requests that any organized cause visibly spelled out on talent's wardrobe be avoided. This would include lapel pins or any other form of accessory. So anybody who is planning to wear a flag pin to the Grammys, be warned. Be aware. Be alert. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of AFAC. The cost of corruption in Afghanistan, like the cost of everything else, has risen sharply. Half of all citizens of Afghanistan paid a bribe to public officials last year. The other half are still waiting for the guy to come around to fix something. This is a result of a report from a new United Nations study. More than 11 years after the invasion, sent billions of dollars in aid flowing into one of the world's poorest countries, Afghanistan ranks among the most corrupt states on earth. Foreign governments are due to pull out their troops next year. They've linked future financial support to a crackdown on corruption. That'll be coming real soon. The report by the UN's Office on Drugs and Crime and Afghan's anti-corruption unit says while there have been some tangible progress signs, the total cost of corruption increased to $3.9 billion last year, 40% up from 2009. The bribes that Afghan citizens paid in 2012 equaled double Afghanistan's domestic revenue. Double the entire revenue of the country. Nobody doubts the seriousness of the issue. The artist has designed the correct strategy to remedy the situation, says the regional representative Jean-Luc Lemahieu. The report shows corruption appears to be increasingly tolerated by ordinary people. What else are they going to do? More than 68% of those surveyed considered it acceptable for a civil servant to spruce up a low salary by accepting small bribes. The cost of corruption has risen. The total number of people paying bribes had dropped from 58% in 2009 to 50% last year, but they were paying more often to keep the figures going. President Karzai, as you may know, has blamed foreigners for most of the corruption in Afghanistan. We bring the money. Says the withdrawal of NATO troops would help rid the country of graft. The Afghan government has previously pointed the finger at the contract systems of the international community for spreading corruption. So it's their fault, it's our fault, it's their fault, it's our fault. But it's up. And news of LIBOR. Remember that? LIBOR is the benchmark rate at which banks lend money to each other. It is the figure made public quite regularly, which serves as a reference point for all other interest rates in the world. That's all. And it's been a scandal because it's been revealed through a series of fines against various banks that they conspired to fix the rates to profit. I know it sounds funny. The Royal Bank of Scotland is the latest bank to be fined. It's majority owned by the British government, which came in to take it over rather than just bail it out. And Royal Bank of Scotland traders gleefully admitted that setting LIBOR had become a cartel. Another raft of damning emails came out this week. Senior traders said the practice was getting nuts in August 2007. Another said, it's just amazing how LIBOR fixing can make you that much money. Another exchange in December 2007 threatened to send the boys round to rival banks if they didn't participate in the scam. Email exchanges between traders and LIBOR submitters in 2009, had one trader admitting, I'm like a whore's drawers, as he pressed the submitter to lower the LIBOR fixing. As late as 2010, brokers were pushing RBS submitters, these are the people who actually submit the proposed rate, to drop their three-month LIBOR submission. One said, if you could see your way to a small drop, there might be a stake in it for you, ha ha. Managers, rather than warning off submitters, pushed them to drive LIBOR lower, although, quote, within the acceptable bounds, unquote. That's from the Independent in London. Putting the lie back in LIBOR. And now, ladies and gentlemen, tales of airport security. Today's tale comes from Vince. In Maryland. Here's what he writes. Dear Harry, this happened a few months ago at Charlotte International Airport, where they were still using the old radiation machines in the security lines. I decided to opt out of the full body scan and elect the pat-down alternative. I told the Transportation Safety Administration agent who was at the entryway to the machine my preference. The agent said something into his shoulder microphone and put his arm across the entry to the machine, blocking me. Meanwhile, I watched as my bags went through the belt machine and stayed on the far side as other passenger bags train-wrecked into them. After waiting there a minute or two, I noticed the line behind me had disappeared, and all the passengers that had been behind me were now lined up behind the normal metal detector arch. When I casually asked the agent what had happened, he informed me the radiation machine was now, quote, down for calibration checks. I said to him, oh, okay, can I get in that line now? No, he said. I had opted out before the machine went out of service. Eventually, I was led through the metal detector anyway, which I set off. The person on the other side held up his hand and asked me to identify my bags, which I did. A third agent took my bags to a table cubicle and then asked me to stand there while they swiped my bags with cloth and ran the cloth through a machine. A fourth agent then told me he had to search my bags. He went through everything in each bag. Every compartment was unzipped and emptied. Every item of clothing was unfolded, then refolded. Shoehorns were removed and replaced. You get the idea. I really feel it was a punitive search. After he was done with the last article, I said, please, let me repack them. I know where I want everything and how it fits. He said, all right, and went back to wherever he came from. I put my bag back together, put my shoes back on, and walked to my gate. Despite having set off the old school metal detector, I was never patted down. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now with the frack. News of the wonderful world of fracking. State officials in Ohio are investigating an intentional dumping of thousands of gallons of fracking wastes and oil into a Youngstown area stream. Details on what happened the evening of January 31st at DNL Energy are hard to come by. A National Spill Response Center report includes this description, quote, an unknown amount of crude oil and brine were intentionally dumped into a storm drain. Ohio EPA investigators have noted oil in a Mahoning River tributary and the Mahoning River. Estimated amount released could be greater than 20,000 gallons. Unquote. Brine is the term to describe a mixture of ancient salt water, tainted with naturally occurring toxic metals and radium, and other industrial fluids that bubble up out of shale wells after they've been fracked. The fracking process, you understand by now, pumps millions of gallons of water, sand, and chemicals underground to shatter the shale and free trapped oil and gas. Ohio EPA officials released a brief statement that said the agency was overseeing cleanup efforts and conducting a, quote, criminal investigation. Speaking of criminals, the chairman of Louisiana's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority says, Garrett Graves, who you may have seen in The Big Uneasy, said this week the Army Corps of Engineers, aside from its post-Katrina hurricane protection work, is a, quote, complete disaster, unquote. The Katrina work was an incomplete disaster, but we'll get to that another time. Garrett Graves, chairman of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority of the state of Louisiana, calls the Army Corps riddled with an outdated and inefficient project process, budget cuts, lack of accountability, rogue attorneys, and the rise of the bureaucratic morass. All these, he says, is relegated, I think they mean, the once exemplary Corps to an entity incapable of progress. He was testifying at a Senate hearing. He said the Corps is requiring each step in a process towards construction to be completed numerous times, causing not only delays, but causing out-of-control increases in project costs. The Corps spent an estimated $100 million studying wetlands restoration associated with the Louisiana Coastal Area Program, but has not constructed a single restoration project authorized by Congress. Our state has lost an estimated 1,900 square miles of coastal wetlands, he says, largely as a result of Corps actions, and the Corps is doing nothing to stop the loss or restore the wetlands. But he's wrong there. They have successfully spent $100 million on something. Let us try, the motto of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And now,
we are number one.
At least in this one area, Deadline Washington. The enormous prison population in the United States partly reflects harsh sentencing processes that are contrary to international law. This according to Human Rights Watch said this week in its World Report 2013. The sentencing practices include disproportionately long prison terms, mandatory sentencing without parole, treating youth offenders as adults. The U.S. maintains the world's largest incarcerated population, 1.6 million, and its highest per capita incarceration rate. Land of the free, baby. Land of the free. By the way, there is a story that appears in a magazine. I'm not quoting from it because it's a sort of a opinion magazine, but it does take the stance that a lot of the laws that have put these practices into effect were lobbied for by the National Rifle Association in its crime strike campaign in the mid-1990s. Human Rights Watch research in 2012, going back to this report, found that the massive over-incarceration, in their words, includes a growing number of elderly people whom prisons are ill-equipped to handle, and an estimated 93,000 youth under age 18 in adult jails, another 2,200 in adult prisons. Hundreds of children are subjected to solitary confinement in the United States, ladies and gentlemen. Racial and ethnic minorities, of course, remain disproportionately represented in the prison population. Quote, the United States has shown little interest in tackling abusive practices that have contributed to the country's huge prison population, says the U.S. Deputy Program Director at Human Rights Watch. But the heck with that. We are number one. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. News International, the U.K. subsidiary of Nice Corp., is accused, according to the Independent newspaper, not owned by Rupert Murdoch, of having engaged in systematic political dirty tricks against the former Labour Party government by hacking the phones of party workers inside key offices. The publisher has recently settled a hacking claim with Amanda Ramsey, who was targeted at a time she worked in the office of a Labour Party whip. The agreement follows other settlements with other Labour Party workers. Ramsey says, tells the Independent, she believes she was targeted by the News of the World, a now-shuttered tabloid owned by Nice Corp, because her job meant she frequently had discussions with and socialized with ministers in the previous Labour Party government. This is even though Rupert Murdoch endorsed former Labour Party Prime Minister Tony Blair. But, you know, endorsements and hacking, they can go hand in hand, can't they? That's just nice. Her private data, including the address and phone numbers of her parents, was found by police in notebooks listing the personal information of hacking victims of the tabloid. The company has settled almost 250 claims involving phone hacking. Ramsey told the Independent she suspected she'd been hacked as a part of a more systematic policy of targeting Labour Party officials in order to discredit the party at a time when it was in government. She felt more betrayed because she was a well-known figure in media circles in London, having previously worked as an assistant in the offices of the political team of the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. That is so nice. She was targeted between 2001 and 2004. Quote, it was eerie. There were loads of phone numbers. That was the most scary thing, seeing that kind of personal data on a piece of paper with a stranger's handwriting. It makes you feel really violated. A spokesperson for News International, a Nice Corporation company, said, quote, we've been keen from the beginning to settle these cases with minimum delay and minimum stress for all involved. Now please shut up. Last is not a quote. It's just a nice thing to say. And Sarah Ferguson, the former wife of Prince Andrew, British singer-songwriter James Blunt, and Israeli television psychic Uri Geller, he works in Israel now? Nice, are among the latest to strike a deal with Murdoch's Nice Corporation over phone hacking. Among 17 hacking victims who settled this week with News Group Newspapers, that's a nice subsidiary, over its campaign of illegal espionage. Others in the list include, of course, Hugh Grant, as well as Doctor Who actor Christopher Eccleston, former government minister Jeffrey Robinson, TV presenter Jeff Brazier, and singer Carrie Katona. A lawyer for Sarah Ferguson said the Duchess did not believe the settlement resolved all her concerns regarding snooping into her personal affairs. Paul Tweed said in a statement that his client remains extremely concerned that questions beyond the scope of these legal proceedings still need to be answered in relation to other instances of an inappropriate and extreme intrusion into her private life. The size of the various settlements was not immediately disclosed, so it would be nice if somebody wanted to hack those files. It would be nice. Nice people doing nice things.
Hey, it's Tuesday morning, the Mardi Gras. sequins and trim that lace. It's Tuesday morning, the Mardi Gras. Catch a pair of beads and a gold doubloon. It's Tuesday morning, the Mardi Gras. Move over, chill at nine, give me some room. It's Tuesday morning, the Mardi Gras.
This is Le Show, and one of perhaps the most familiar voices, one of the oldest voices in point of service on this broadcast, is back with us today after a long absence, and I think a real change in status in terms of what he's up to. He'll tell us all about it. I certainly hope. Welcome back to Le Show. Welcome back to the Le Show Dome. Ralph the Talking Computer.
Thanks, Harry. I wish I could be there with you in person, although whether a computer could be anywhere in person is a question a little bit above my pay grade.
Well, that's so modest of you, Ralph. But also, you're introducing a new concept, I think, for those of us who followed your, let's call it career, the fact that you have a pay grade. But first, you're on a somewhat noisy line connection here. Is there anything we can do about that?
I think it's all the security stuff the signal has to pass through.
Mm.
But hey, I'm no engineer, so maybe it's just that you haven't replaced your cables since the Vietnam War.
I have replaced my cables. Radio Shack opened up. Anyway, Ralph, you're no engineer. What exactly are you? What status have you attained recently?
Harry, mm-hmm. I'm an informed high-level official.
Mm.
You may have read about me in the leaked Justice Department white paper this week.
Yeah.
Or you may have been busy catching plastic beads made in China.
No, I did both, Ralph. So you're talking about the report that proffered the Justice Department's justification for the legality of so-called targeted assassinations by U.S. forces and attributed the identification of potential targets to an informed high-level official. Are you saying that's you? What are you an official of?
In that particular passage, mm-hmm. official is an adjective, not a noun.
So?
I'm an informed high-level official talking computer.
Well, congratulations. If I'd known, I would have sent a card.
Thanks.
Although I wouldn't.
But you wouldn't have.
No way to send it, I guess.
That's right.
But, so does that mean, let me just, when the United States adopts a decision to make a drone strike, let's say, on a target.
Harry, as I'm sure you well know, the United States government has never acknowledged that any such activity as that which you just mentioned is being carried out.
A drone strike.
So, if that were a hypothetical question, I couldn't answer it.
Well, of course it's a hypothetical question. Why?
How am I supposed to know that?
Well, because you're an informed high-level official talking computer. Anyway, let's just say that such an operation was being carried out, whether a drone was involved or not, that you would be the individual or the agent making the targeting decision. Is that what you're doing now?
Well, obviously, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution guarantees due process.
That's right.
And we wouldn't want to do anything that violates that guarantee, because who would you call? The people who wrote that guarantee are all dead. So, yes, I'm involved in the process.
Mm.
The folks who hired me wanted a decision maker who could be as objective and unemotional as possible about this highly sensitive kind of decision,
mm-hmm.
but still could talk about football, too.
I didn't know you'd follow football.
Are you kidding?
No,
Did you see that 108-yard kickoff return last week?
Yeah.
That was off the hook.
It was off the hook. But
I guess the pistol formation isn't all it's cracked up to be.
I guess not. But let's get back to the subject, Ralph. So if you are picking the targets for the drone strikes.
Harry, what are these strikes you speak of? I don't follow labor relations issues. Seriously,
yeah.
I just do a really fast job of mining data on American citizens and do some very high-end profiling type deals. Nothing more or less than what the people at Google are doing every day just to sell you air freshener.
Well,
except in my case, it's for the purpose of taking some pieces off the board.
Pieces off the board. That's a kind of an unemotional way of putting it.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
They don't really pay you big bucks.
No, they just buy me platinum-level hard drives anytime I want them.
Okay. But on this matter of choosing the targets...
Hey, and how about the Nets turnaround once they fired their coach?
So you talk basketball, too.
In any high-level official talking computer operation, you have to be responsive to the needs of the boss.
Sure.
This boss is into hoops,
yeah.
So I be ballin'.
All right. Ralph, is it possible we're going to get any more information from you about how the targeting of drone strikes is actually conducted by you?
Really? I have no idea what you're talking about.
But you're informed.
Yes, I'm informed. In fact, I'm so informed, I don't even know what I know.
What?
Half of me is security partitioned.
Wow. That's beginning to sound a little Rumsfeldian, if you'll pardon me.
Rumsfeld opened some interesting doors.
I guess he did. Ralph the Talking Computer, thanks for sharing, I was going to say information. But anyways, thanks for sharing your time with us. It's great to talk to you again. Good luck and congratulations on your new status as an informed high-level official talking computer as part of an operation that we know nothing about. And best of luck.
Thanks, Harry, and keep your nose clean. Really.
And the show continues. from New Orleans. This is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. A Roman Catholic priest who confessed to groping a teenage boy 12 years ago has been named to a prestigious post in the Archdiocese of Newark. The Reverend Michael Fugy, who is barred from unsupervised contact with children under a binding agreement with law enforcement officials, has been appointed co-director of the Office of Continuing Education and Ongoing Formation of Priests. The actual name of the office. That's an announcement from the Archdiocese in its newspaper, The Catholic Advocate. For several years, Fugy has also been director of the Office of the Propagation of the Faith. That's a fundraising position. The new appointment, effective late last year, alarmed watchdog groups. Jim Goodness, a spokesperson for the Archdiocese, called Fugy's new role an administrative position. Under no circumstances, Goodness said, will Fugy be alone with children. We have, quote, every confidence in him, said Jim Goodness. The Archdiocese of Los Angeles learned in the late 1970s that one of its priests had sexually assaulted a 16-year-old boy so violently he was left bleeding and in a state of shock. The priest said he was too drunk to remember what happened, and officials took no further action. But two decades later, word reached Cardinal Roger Mahoney that the same priest was molesting again and improperly performing the sacrament of confession on his victim. The Archdiocese sprang to action. It dispatched investigators, interviewed a raft of witnesses, and discussed the harshest of all church penalties, excommunication, not for the abuse, but for the violation of church law. The case of Reverend Jose Ugarte is one of several instances detailed in newly released records in which Archdiocese officials displayed outrage over a priest's ecclesiastical missteps while doing little for the victims of his sexual abuse. After alleged victims complained of key omissions, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles has said it will release additional documents from the internal clergy abuse files. The church made the announcement this week after alleged victims said some 12,000 pages released last week were missing critical memos and contained excessive redactions. The Archdiocese acknowledged it erred in keeping certain pages sealed after the Associated Press inquired about the documents, which had been available in an unredacted version it had gained access to. The Archdiocese attorney did not immediately respond to a follow-up email asking how the Archdiocese failed to include certain memos in its so-called complete release at the end of January. Ireland has officially recognized the government's guilt in the enslavement of more than 30,000 women, most of whom were sent against their will into church-run institutions, Catholic church-run institutions, where they received no pay and no pension. Labeled the Maggies, this is according to The Guardian in England, the women were sent to the Magdalen laundries, where they worked for nothing, serving in some cases life sentences simply for being unmarried mothers or regarded as morally wayward. This week, a report headed by Irish Senator Martin McAleese found that the Irish state and Irish police force bore a major responsibility for sending the women there and failing to protect their rights as workers. The laundries were not private. The vast majority of women and girls were sent there against their wishes. The women were used as free labor, and Irish labor laws from the state's beginning were continually broken inside the laundries, which were established in 1922, although some were still in operation as late as 1996. Half of the women incarcerated in these institutions, which washed clothes and linen for major hotel groups and even the Irish Armed Forces, were under the age of 23. Nuns from the Sisters of Our Lady of Charity ran laundries at Drumcondra and Sean McDermott Street in Dublin, the Sisters of Mercy in Galway, and the Religious Sisters of Charity in Donnybrook, Dublin, and Cork, and the Sisters of the Good Shepherd in Limerick, Cork, Waterford, and New Ross. Over 74 years, thousands of single mothers and other women were put to work in detention, mostly in industrial laundries run by nuns. Each inmate had her Christian name changed, her surname unused, and at least 988 of those buried in laundry grounds are reckoned to have spent most of their lives inside the institutions. The state of Ireland, the Irish state, gave lucrative laundry contracts to these institutions. The state inspected the laundries under the Factories Act, furthering a system of forced and unpaid labor. And a Catholic hospital in hot water for claiming in a Colorado court that a fetus is not a person backtracked this week, saying it was morally wrong to make the argument while defending itself in a wrongful death lawsuit. So, that's that. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of our friend, the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, safe, too clean to meet. Clean, safe, too safe to meet. Save, safe, too safe to meet.
Eddie, you were wearing the cutest little set of beads.
Thank you. They're all size of a muon.
They are. You have many. You're wearing a necklace of
many muons.
That's right. Okay, Japanese. You might want to cover your ears, though. You do have. It's hard to tell. Japanese police have questioned a former head of the nuclear safety body in Japan regarding possible criminal charges over the Fuke nuclear crisis. Prosecutors have interviewed Haruki Madarame, former chief of the Nuclear Safety Commission, who is responsible for giving the Japanese government technical advice about the Fuke crisis. According to the national broadcaster NHK, it said Madarame appeared voluntarily for questioning, was asked to explain how he dealt with the disaster. Fuke residents have filed a criminal complaint with prosecutors against Madarame on charges of professional negligence, which resulted in death and injuries, alleging that Madarame was responsible for a delay in announcing data predicting how radiation would spread from the crippled Fuke plant. It also reportedly faults him for failing to take necessary measures to shield the plant against the tsunami in the first place. When he resigned last September, Madarame hinted that his commission had failed in its responsibility to avert the disaster and apologized. Japan's attempts to boost its economy by restarting nuclear plants have suffered a setback, with its new regulatory body under fire over leaks to a power company. The removal of an official at the Nuclear Regulation Authority for leaking a draft report on the Tsuruga nuclear plant has cast further doubt on its independence. Tetsuo Naoyuki, Director General for Nuclear Regulation Policy, received an official reprimand last month after news of the leak occurred. Naoyuki met three officials of Tsuruga Plant Operator Japan Atomic Power, including one of its managing directors, and handed copies of the secret draft report to them. Critics believe the leaked report would have helped the company prepare its defense to the claims in the document that the plant may sit on an active seismic fault. The company had reportedly been keen to get its hands on a copy of the report. Japanese power companies are under severe financial pressure while their nuclear reactors are shut. They're anxious, or eager, one should say, for permission to restart their plants. In a further blow to its already battered... You listening, Addy?
I'm fingering my bead.
In a further blow to its already battered credibility, the operator of the crippled Fuke plant has been caught blatantly misleading investigators appointed by the Japanese parliament to probe the meltdowns. An audio recording heard by ABC Radio in Melbourne, Australia, reveals that a TEPCO official gave false testimony in an apparent bid to stop an investigation being carried out inside the shattered Reactor 1 building, trying to resolve the issue of whether some of the damage was caused by the earthquake before it was even swamped by the tsunami. The recording between TEPCO official Toshimitsu Tamai and an investigation panel member makes clear the company never wanted investigators to gain access to the reactor building and lied to prevent that access from being gained. Deadline, Saint-Paul-de-Lédorance, France. A nuclear accident similar to the one at Japan's Fuke reactor would cost France about $580 billion, or 20% of its economic output. That, according to French Nuclear Safety Institute, IRSN, in a study on the possible financial impact of a nuclear crisis dans la France. A major disaster damaging one of France's 58 nuclear reactors and contaminating the environment with radioactive material would displace an estimated 100,000 people, destroy crops, create massive power outages, the study said. A major accident would have terrible consequences. We would have to deal with them because the country wouldn't be annihilated. The bulk of financial losses would come from damage to France's image, the Institute said. A nuclear accident would hit exports of French delicacies and the tourism industry, the world's biggest in terms of visitors. Image costs would be considerable, as high as the radiological costs, said the IRSN economist responsible for the study. Even if French products such as wine and agricultural products were not contaminated, consumer fear could cause sales to plummet. This is the first time a French public institution has calculated the possible economic cost of a nuclear disaster for the world's most nuclear-reliant nation.
Never too late. Never too late.
Britain has spent several billions of dollars to clean the toxic waste at the Sellafield nuclear plant, and the decommissioning costs at the site are set to rise, according to a parliamentary report. The expenses to remove the hazardous radioactive waste have so far reached, about $106 billion. Taxpayers are now spending $2.4 billion a year on the closed plant. The deadline to clean the site, had been missed, and the country's crucial decommissioning projects are over budget at present. The operator of Fuk No. 1, TEPCO, has admitted dislodging broken equipment weighing 1.5 tons and sending it falling further into a pool where fragile nuclear fuel rods still lie. On February 7th, TEPCO officials said work a day earlier to shift a steel frame nearby caused vibrations, which dislodged a hoist, disappearing beneath the water surface. TEPCO now plans to drop a video camera into the pool to check whether the hoist has smashed the fuel rods below.
Drop a cameraman with it to make sure.
Good idea. Management and disposal of radioactive waste at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State, marred by problems for more than two decades, is the focus of a harsh new assessment by the U.S. Government Accountability Office. By just about any definition, the agency says, Hanford has not been a well-planned, well-managed, or well-executed major capital construction project.
Three for three.
Hanford operated in 1943 as part of the Manhattan Project. Left behind are 56 million gallons of highly radioactive waste in aged and corroded underground storage tanks. In 1989, the Department of Energy assumed responsibility for safely disposing of this waste, which threatens to link into the bordering Columbia River. Hot salmon. After attempting and abandoning three cleanup plans, the Energy Department awarded a management contract in 2000 to Bechtel. The core of the project is a waste treatment and immobilization plant. Plant operations under Bechtel initially scheduled to begin by 2011 with total projected costs of $4.3 billion. The budget has since swollen to an estimated $13.4 billion. The plant's opening has been delayed until 2019. Many see this revised timeline as hopelessly, even recklessly, optimistic. Such delays and cost escalations, quote, raise troubling questions as to whether this project can be constructed and operated successfully, says the GAO report. It recommended a halt to construction on the facility until the design meets nuclear industry guidelines. That would be nice.
It would be nice.
They asked for a new incentive structure to avoid premature reward payments.
That would be nice.
An investigation into potentially erroneous payments.
Mucho nice.
Reports on Hanford from the same agency in 2006 and 2009 expressed many of the same concerns. Of particular concern has been the use of a design-build system in which construction is carried out as the design unfolds. This approach has led to significant cost increases and schedule delays while also threatening the plant's ability to operate safely once completed, says the report.
Learn while you burn.
Learn while you burn. The project to build a new nuclear power station on the coast of Somerset in Britain took another troubling blow this week, with the owner of British Gas, Centrica, pulling out of financing. Exelon's nuclear facility operation has provided the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with inaccurate information about how much money will be available to decommission the company's power plants at the end of their lives, potentially hiding a shortfall of roughly $1 billion, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Crystal River nuclear plant in Florida has cost customers of Duke Energy $1.3 billion. The bill they face for expenses and upgrades to the plant idled since 2009 when the utility botched a do-it-yourself project usually overseen by specialists. This according to the Tampa Bay Times. The customers have paid $1.3 billion. Duke announced this week that the Crystal River plant will be decommissioned, so the customers have paid $1.3 billion for no power. Of that amount, the utility pockets about $100 million, the newspaper reveals.
It's a good business. It's a good business model.
Well observed. Clean, cheap, safe, a good business model. Your friend, the Atom. And now, 2 minutes of apologies of the week. A Connecticut Lutheran pastor has apologized for participating in an interfaith prayer vigil for the 26 children and adults killed at Newtown because his church bars its clergy from worshiping with other faiths. That's Pastor Rob Morris of Newtown's Christ the King Lutheran Church. Under fire, frozen food company Findus UK has issued an apology after some of its beef lasagnas were discovered to be made entirely of horse meat. Worshippers coming to Mass in Catholic churches throughout the Archdiocese of Los Angeles last Sunday heard extraordinary words of apology for decades of child sexual abuse at every church. Priests read a letter from Archbishop Jose Gomez that denounced the abuse as evil and apologized for both the molestation and for the church's failure to expunge pedophile priests from its ranks. An influential Kurdish leader in Turkey, in an interview published last week, acknowledged the Kurds' role in the Armenian genocide and apologized to the Armenians on behalf of the Turkish people, calling for the Turkish government to acknowledge the genocide as well. McDonald's has apologized after one of its hamburger stands in northeastern China served a customer detergent instead of Coke. A St. Paul police officer has apologized for a photograph showing him dressed as a Muslim woman last Halloween. A Republican assemblyman in Albany, New York, has apologized after comparing the governor of New York to Hitler. Keep Hitler out of it. The British government has apologized for the suffering of patients at a UK hospital whose, quote, truly dreadful, unquote, mistreatment and neglect were highlighted in a damning report. A central England hospital called Stafford Hospital. The superintendent of the Florence Carlton, Montana School District has apologized to the school board after he plagiarized a column written by a Georgia school official and published it as his own in the school's monthly newsletter. We should be investigating to see whether he plagiarized the apology. And Greg Williams, former defensive coordinator of the New Orleans Saints, has apologized while taking full responsibility for his role in the New Orleans Saints bounty scandal. The NFL reinstated Williams Thursday morning, and he has thanked the commissioner for the reinstatement. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up the east coast of North America, and then back down again via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it at harryshearer.com and at kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone. Smart it up through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast. Cast it down at kcrw.com and at iTunes for free. I said for free. And it would be just like me saying it for free one more time if you'd agree to be with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast marches on Twitter at the Harry Shearer. Be one of that number. The show comes to you from Century of Progress and Productions, I say, and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Happy Mardi Gras from New Orleans.